Anxiety and fear are the first two things to look at. But we can have cognitive deficits where people can have brain fog. They don't feel like they can concentrate. They can't pay attention. There can be derealization where things don't feel real off and on. There can be depersonalization where the person doesn't feel real. There can also be existential crises or ontological crises. Why am I here? What does my existence mean?
Welcome to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. I'm your host, Dr. Richard Lewis Miller. The mission of Mind, Body, Health, and Politics is to enhance your physical and emotional well-being and encourage community. I say encourage community because I believe that humans are tribal animals and that we're meant to live tribally in small groups where we know each other by name or at least by face, because when we live that way, we are cooperative, collaborative animals. We like to do things together, hang out together, play games together, create things together, and we love to eat together. We love to sit in circles and share food. We're basically good people, tribal people. But we must also be aware that there's a very small percentage of us, probably less than 5%, maybe smaller than that, who are very different from the rest of us. They are predators. They are dominators. They are the people who, when we came out of the caves, had the biggest club and subjected other people to listen to their will. Then it became gangs and larger, small armies, then cities. Then they decided to take over areas, and they called them countries by making imaginary borders. There are no borders on the planet. When you go up in space and look down, you don't see different countries and different borders. You see a planet. We are one people. But these people act as if we're different people, separate people. Because when they get us fighting amongst ourselves, we don't focus on the fact that they are turning us in, or have already turned us into subjects to do what they want. And that's what we must always be mindful of. In our democracy, in our republic, we must remain aware of the fragility of what we have and the importance of what we have. In the words of one of my great heroes, Thomas Jefferson, eternal vigilance is the price of liberty. Today, on Mind, Body, Health, and Politics, I am greatly honored to have Dr. Robert Strahan here. I could go on probably for half the show just telling you about what he brings to the table in terms of credentials. He's a PhD. He's a black belt in martial arts. He's a colonel in the military and lots more. Welcome to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics, Robert.
Thank you very much, and the pleasure is all mine. Thank you.
Robert, I think you may have been told that I'm writing a book on psychedelic medicine adverse effects.
Yes.
And I know that you've done a lot of important work in the area of adverse effects. And I'd like to talk to you about that work today, because I'm very concerned, Robert. I'm concerned about the fact that big pharma, when they have adverse effects, they call them side effects to trivialize them as if they happen on the side and you don't really have to pay attention. But you and I both know from our decades and decades of experience that these effects don't happen on the side. They happen to the whole system, to our physical and emotional, psychological system. It happens to all of us. And so we have to be honest with the public and tell them when there are adverse effects and not trivialize them. So I'm making this contribution in the psychedelic community to ring the bell and say, let's tell all the effects to everybody so everybody knows. You've delved into some tough topics. And What got you into studying adverse effects to begin with, Robert?
Well, first of all, I mean, you have to look at it from the standpoint, or at least I began to look at it from the standpoint of clinical trials. Clinical trials have involved a small number of people, and you have exclusion criteria, you have inclusion criteria, and you generally won't have those things, assuming that these medications are rescheduled. People like me will see patients, and there won't be exclusion criteria. There won't be inclusion criteria. We'll have to look at screening patients carefully to make sure that they're appropriate candidates for the use. But also, we got to keep in mind that over 98 or 99% of the people who use psychedelics don't use them in medically supervised settings. And as a result, side effects don't go reported as frequently in the main scientific literature. So again, we have to, some of the researchers will say that the absence of evidence is the evidence of absence, but when you look at the resurgence of papers being published now about adverse effects, some of which last for a year, 3 years, and result in lasting psychological or neurocognitive impairments. And in order to advise the public on how to use these medicines safely, because whether they're prescribed or not, people are going to continue to use them recreationally, they're going to use them for spiritual expansion, and they need to know how to use them safely.
When you're vetting people, screening them for psychedelics, can you tell us some of the big items that you look for in screening people that you want to warn the public about right now?
Well, and that's one of the things that doesn't really happen, to my knowledge, to a great degree in the underground or when people are just using it on their own. Even here in the small town where I practice medicine, which has about 30,000 people, probably 2 or 3 times a month, we have people come in who have taken big doses of psilocybin, MDMA, LSD, and then they wonder why they're ill or they're sick. So to avoid misdiagnosis or mislabeling these people, there are certain ways to treat them, but they don't have the advantage of that. But the things that I do when I'm working with ketamine, which is right now the only real legal psychedelic that can be prescribed, is
ketamine, yes, except for Colorado and Oregon, of course, where yes. Psilocybin is also allowed to be used in certain conditions.
And those conditions, and I've looked at their consent form, generally it dodges the issue of medical use, but I don't see how they're going to get around it. But that's another topic.
Yeah.
But I generally look at people and screen them for health-related issues. Do they have existing physical conditions that would be either relative contraindications or absolute contraindications for the use? I ask them things about have they been exposed to psychedelics before, and what have their experiences been like? Have they had challenging experiences? I screen them for past history of mental illness in themselves, family history of mental illness. I also screen them for things like, have they ever received treatment in an underground setting? Have they been prepared for those types of interactions? So oftentimes people just show up, they get the drug and they take them, but there's not really a attention paid to preparation. So thoroughly talking to people about what the experience could be like, realizing that each psychedelic experience can be very unique, very unpredictable. So it's hard to say you will have this experience. We can only say generally this is what happens. And you have to inform people that there is a small risk of enduring side effects, so that then the person is able to make a rational, informed consent to the medicine or say, this is not for me. And then it's incumbent on the prescriber to say, this medicine may not be for you. maybe you can try something else. But there's the myth that every psychedelic experience turns out for the good, and that's not true.
Yes. And there are risk factors that you're talking about. I think you've covered quite a few of them. Once a person passes the test and they feel comfortable, and maybe the guide or yourself feels comfortable, what do you recommend in terms of preparing for the experience before the experience?
In general, what happens is there's a conversation with the patient about what happens, and it's usually a logistics. So you show up at this time, you seek the medicine, you have to have someone bring you, you have to have someone bring you back. What common transient side effects are usually expected. But I think one of the better approaches as this field evolves is meditation and certain psychedelic states or non-ordinary states of consciousness are pretty similar. So if memory serves me, one of the pioneers with ketamine-assisted therapy, a Russian named Krupinsky, required that people go through meditation classes first. They go through yoga classes. They eat well. They learn how to sleep well. And they learn how to breathe. Because, say, for instance, a person is involved in a challenging experience. Well, we're all taught to tell them to breathe in and out through the nose and mouth and fall into the situation to see what the experience has to teach you. However, if a person doesn't know how to breathe in that way, through diaphragmatic breathing, ways to relax themselves, the time to learn it is not when you're in the middle of a challenging experience. So I think in addition to giving them cognitive aspects of what could happen and procedural aspects of what could happen, it's really important to prepare the person for a non-ordinary state of consciousness as much as possible so that it doesn't overwhelm them. And then it results in a fear-related or anxiety-related response that is most often associated with a long-term adverse outcome.
Robert, breathing is my number one tool. I've used breathing to save my own life when I was completely run over by a Winnebago recreational vehicle that crushed my legs, and I saved my life with breathing. You are the first person, the first scientist and practitioner, when I've asked a question about preparation, to talk about breathing. I agree with you 100%. It's an essential tool. It's, you know, it's faster than a speeding Valium for dealing with anxiety. So thank you for bringing that and putting it out on the table for everybody to hear. And I hope I want to underline it for you, folks. Dr. Robert Strahan. I'm taking the liberty of calling him Robert. He's talking to us about the essential, really, of learning diaphragmatic breathing before the psychedelic experience, right? You want to take care of the leak in your roof before the winter storms. Be prepared. Let's move on next. So that's a bit of preparation. What about the connection between the psychedelic experience and yoga? How can one build yoga into their program? And I ask you that because I know, in addition to the other things I described about your amazing credentials, you're also an expert yoga practitioner.
I am a yoga practitioner. I'm not as flexible in body, but I hope my mind continues to become flexible. But I think the yoga practice is valuable for two reasons. One is that it familiarizes you with breathing, but it also familiarizes you with how your body works. Because some of the long-lasting side effects of the psychedelics involve body sensations. So again, if these things are strange and you don't know how to sit with your own body, then it can become something that's terrifying, something that's unexpected. And you may feel that your body is betraying you. And sometimes people who have an uncomfortable or very challenging adverse reaction to the psychedelics, they can feel that their mind is betraying them. So the visual things that can occur, the bodily things that can occur, yoga puts you in more sync with your body so that you can make a place for these changes and not fight them and make them potentially worse.
Robert, when did you sign up for this 200-hour course in yoga?
Oh, approximately 3 years ago.
3 years ago. And how old are you now?
68.
Part of what you're saying to the world in doing that is at age 65, practicing medicine and having the busy life you have, you signed up for a 200-hour yoga class. That's as important for people to hear as anything else we've said today, because you're saying it's possible, more than possible, I'm doing it, to be taking classes, serious ones, lengthy ones, and starting at 65. School doesn't end in high school or college. We can go on learning, getting trained, getting mentored for the rest of our lives, including myself at 85.
And I think one of the things that I tell my patients is the psychedelics, as Stan Grof says, are non-specific amplifiers. But by the same token, we should all want to live and put in the work that's necessary. So sometimes I call it the butterflies and fairies. People have these wonderful experiences and they have what they feel is enlightenment or a kundalini experience. However, that's the exception rather than the rule. Most people have to put in work. And even if you do have a good psychedelic experience, then you have to integrate it into daily life. What meaning does it have? And if you're healthy physically, mentally, and spiritually, then those things flow much more smoothly. But if you're depending on the psychedelic alone to make the change, then that leads people to chase the metastatic medicine. And then you end up rolling the dice. The more times that you do them, and although it's relatively rare, the more chances that you have to have a challenging or a negative experience. Plus, most people don't know how to follow up with the experience. So people are left out there on their own. They have to resort to being shut off and not talking to other people and suffering unnecessarily. So I think talking about the potential adverse effects of the psychedelics allows us to not only look at the benefits, but look at the potential risk so that people can use them in a safe manner. So it's about harm reduction as much as anything else.
Robert, one of the many things you teach your patients and students is to learn how to differentiate between challenging events and adverse effects. Would you please elaborate on that for us?
Okay. When I sit with someone, and it's a privilege for me to sit with someone in a non-ordinary state of consciousness, I've always learned that it's okay to let people struggle some because they're trying to come up with their own answer. I shouldn't give them an answer. However, there's a difference between a struggle and panic, a struggle and fear, a struggle and being overcome by the situation. So I have in my ketamine practice, rescue medicines. So I anticipate common side effects. So nausea can be one. So I have Zofran available. Anxiety can be one. And if they're really anxious, then I have lorazepam or Ativan available so that it can stop that process. So sometimes people say that a bad trip, so to speak, can't be stopped. And that's not true. So one of the things that happened when I was trying to get involved in research was some of the CEOs or primary investigators would say, Dr. Strahan, if you wanted to stop a psilocybin experience, what would you do? And so that started me thinking, there's words to the 5-HT2A receptors, they're agonists, and if the person is in what's called a serotonergic crisis, then a over-the-counter medicine that you can use, not over-the-counter, but prescription medicine, is periactin or ciproheptadine, because it's an antagonist. So if you have those rescue meds available, you don't have to sit by passively and watch, as people in the South say, if you're on the train tracks, you hear the horn and you see the lights, then why wait to get run over? If the person is in a state that you can reasonably assume is due to a serotonergic access,
yes,
then having a rescue med that blocks that can,
yes,
be helpful.
Spell the name of the medicine that you referenced.
The trade name, and it's a generic now, is periactin, periactin. And the generic name is ciproheptadine, ciproheptadine. So if I were using those medicines and I saw that the person was being overcome by fear and anxiety, then that might be a medication to use in the acute setting. If it was MDMA, then of course you wouldn't use the antidepressants that are serotonergic. You'd also be careful, because for some people, usually not in a research setting, but in a non-medically supervised setting, they have a depressive-like syndrome and they have difficulty sleeping after they use MDMA. So you would use supplements like 5-HTP. You would use things like vitamin supplements, B12, folic acid, so that the person isn't depleted in serotonin, and you give them something to help them sleep. So you anticipate the common side effects, but with the ones that can occur later on and are more lasting, there's a small literature that indicates that medications like Lamictal or Lamotrigine can be helpful because, say, for instance, with ketamine, it's a glutaminergic agent. Lamotrigine is a glutaminergic antagonist. An agonist, and so it can offset some of the effects. So in theory, if someone was having an adverse effect from ketamine, giving them lamotrigine could help. But the funny thing about it is, literature says that it knocks out all the dissociative things like depersonalization, derealization, but it enhances the affective response. So it can actually make the mood relief better. So when you look at these types of medications, and these all are medications or psychedelic medicines, whether they're plant or synthetic, you have to anticipate that. What are the potential side effects? If I have something that's long-term, then probably the worst thing you could do is what's commonly done is, well, your experience is not quite solid, take more. No. If you're really panicked, if you're really in fear, taking more, the metaphor is, if you had a fire in your house, you wouldn't put more wood on the fire. You put water on it. So you would want it to stop. So at that point where fear is overwhelming, then you have to do something else. And other medicines are useful for the acute phases, and other medicines can be useful, although research is just, how shall I say, beginning. In management of the long-term side effects. So some people have uncomfortable and very challenging adverse effects, which can in and of themselves, according to the literature, be traumatic. So clonidine, which can be used for the treatment of post-traumatic stress disorder or other acute stress reactions, can be used to modify the effects of where people have been traumatized by the bad experience with the psychedelics. So some of these people can suffer for years, and some of the literature seems to indicate even for decades based on
self-reports. Years, you're running into people who have unwanted complications of medicine, which is what I call them. They're running into unwanted complications that are lasting for years, you say.
Some of the literature, and I've attached to it links to that.
Mostly anxiety or other symptoms as well?
Anxiety and fear are the first two things to look at. But we can have cognitive deficits where people can have brain fog. They don't feel like they can concentrate. They can't pay attention. There can be derealization where things don't feel real off and on. There can be depersonalization where the person doesn't feel real. There can also be existential crises or ontological crises. Why am I here? What does my existence mean? There's a wide variety of symptoms that can occur, and people think that flashbacks, which can be expected in the first 24 to 72 hours and be welcome, versus hallucinogen persisting perceptual disorders, which is more serious. And it comes in two types, and HPPD2 is the one that can last for months or years, where they have floaters, where they have streamers, where things move when they shouldn't move. And it doesn't just involve visual aspects, it involves bodily aspects as well. So proper diagnosis will result in proper treatment, but as Hippocrates said, prevention is what you really want to do. You don't want to have to be at the point where you're treating something that went wrong. You want to try to prevent it.
I'm a great believer in prevention. I spend a lot of my life personally working on convention, so I'm with you on that. Lasting for years, that's very long. And I hear that some medicines work. I know of a case of a fellow who took MDMA and how he's about a year out and he's still having anxiety and panic. However, he was having anxiety and panic before he took MDMA, but he does believe that it was exacerbated. He was very upset. It didn't calm him down and took him in the other direction. I was fascinated to hear you mention Klonopin, because I know Klonopin is an anticonvulsive, and evidently it calms the musculature and reduces the anxiety that way. Is that right?
Well, there's clonidine that can be helpful, and benzodiazepines as a class can also be helpful. But Lamotrigine or Lamictal is an anticonvulsant, which can also be used as a mood stabilizer. There's some indication that Depakote can also be helpful, or valproic acid. But
people are afraid of Depakote because of the tardive dyskinesia that is in the wind about it.
Well, actually, Depakote doesn't cause tardive dyskinesia. It's medicines like Haldol, Thorazine, Meloril.
But Depakote got the reputation, even though it might not have been deserved. I know that, here in California. That's interesting,
yes,
that it doesn't really do it.
No, that's a reputation it doesn't deserve.
So let's talk about two kinds of therapy, if they're different. One is what you might call regular therapy, and the other is therapy following a psychedelic experience that is sometimes referred to as integration. Talk to us about how much they're different, how much they're the same, and what recommendations you make post-psychedelic experience.
Well, one of the requirements that I have is that a person is in therapy before we begin any exposures to ketamine.
More preparation. Now you're talking preparation again, right?
Yes.
Okay.
And so when they come out of the experience, and we would think when they come out of the experience with any other psychedelic, there's a certain amount of integration that occurs post the event. But you want that person to basically, and it sounds hokey, but to let their inner healer come up with their own answers. But some of those issues will come up later in therapy, and you need someone to help them to, again, continue to integrate that into real life. So some people have tried to use different types of therapy, dialectic behavioral therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, ACT therapy, things of that nature. So there's not one size fits all. But it seems like the critical factor is having a therapist who accepts the person on their own terms, doesn't make judgments about the person's experience, gains their trust, and is able to ideally have some idea of what a non-ordinary state of consciousness is like. So it's not necessary that the provider or the therapist use psychedelics themselves, but a very useful course, and you'll like this one, is Stanislav Grof's holotropic breathwork seminars, where I've had one of the most profound non-ordinary states of consciousness utilizing Dr. Grof's breath technique, and many other people will say the same thing. So again, if the person, it almost harkens back to the old days where people thought, well, if you were going to be a psychoanalyst, that you had to have your own analysis. So in a parallel manner, it's difficult for someone to understand a non-ordinary state of consciousness if they haven't experienced it themselves. And an easy way to do it legally is through breath work, through yoga, through meditation, and if you're in a training program that allows you to be exposed in a research setting to MDMA or psilocybin, that's one way. But in many training programs that authorize use of ketamine, that person has the choice of gaining that experience too.
In your work and your writings, you talk about the importance of what you call truly informed in consent based on realistic benefits and risks. So this takes place before the psychedelic journey in order to get the consent. And this is part of another part of preparation, correct?
Yes. And again, I have yet to publish on the topics, but I'm aware of the literature. And the legal basis, it used to be a landmark case called Nathanson versus Klein, where the person was told what the reasonable practitioner wanted them to know. But that was overturned in a landmark case, subsequent case called Canterbury versus Spence, where the standard is now you have to tell the person what the reasonable individual would want to know. So again, you can't say, well, you won't get this side effect. You'll only get beneficial effects. An example would be like if you had surgery. They're going to tell you everything. This could happen, up to and including death. So fortunately, that's not really the case with psychedelics, except if you overdose, take huge amounts of MDMA, and you have cardiac conditions, or you're not properly screened for ibogaine, and you could have fatal conditions. But by and large, the psychedelics have a wide margin of safety. But the thing to advise them about is a small number of people do have lasting effects. And so then it's our responsibility to tell what those effects could be. Not that you will get them, but these are what they could be and what's their common occurrence or infrequent occurrence, so that the person then can say, this sounds like something that I want to do. But without giving them some idea about the possible long-term adverse effect, then they don't have truly informed consent. And they're going to be irritated and angry because of, you didn't tell me this could happen. And the other thing that people seem to fail to do, and I actually had a young man, had an underground experience, he had a bad outcome, and the people who gave him the underground experience didn't follow up with him at all. And I don't think it's because they were bad people. I just don't think that they knew how, because they were functioning under the assumption that nothing bad happens. And sometimes it does.
So I want to pause for a moment now and give you a chance to reflect and answer the question, is there something about this general topic of adverse effects of psychedelics that you'd like to say that you didn't say so far? Anything popping?
I think the other thing is, again, since this is mostly a non-medical use, and some people use them recreationally, some people use them for spiritual transformation, one of the hazards is the purity of the substance that you get. I mean, a lot of MDMA is not MDMA. It has stimulants in it. And you don't know the purity. There's no quality control. So I would say if a person is going to engage in this type of activity, there should be some way to test the medicine to see if it's pure. And if you can't test, at least have someone that you can trust as much as you can to provide you with the real substance. But other dangers about it are not combining psychedelics. So it's very popular or common thing on the ground is kidney flipping, where you use ketamine and MDMA. And I've heard people say, well, you want to use MDMA and then psilocybin, and then you do this, do that. And so when you start mixing those different classes of medicine, then the side effects or potential for side effects becomes more unpredictable. For most people, there's no harm, but for some people who are predisposed, either their metabolism is different or they have a psychiatric history or things as subtle as if you were having a bad day, if you were very stressed, if you didn't really trust the situation, the people that you were around, setting is important. And like I said, those things, and one of the issues that was brought out was the psychedelics can involve neuroplasticity. In other words, help make different brain connections. So with some of the long-lasting benefits of the psychedelics, these new connections are made and a sustained good mood and remission in the illnesses are available. But similarly, if the set and setting is not good, some of those connections are made in a maladaptive way, then you can get these long-term side effects. So again, it's harder to reverse those things once they've taken place. So being careful about the drugs, being careful about the purity, don't use more than one. Use them in comfortable surroundings with people that you trust and people that follow up with you. And then those things minimize with proper screening, proper prevention, can minimize the possibility of an adverse effect. Doesn't guarantee it, but it minimizes it.
Back in the early 1980s, when MDMA was still legal, I got together with a group of five other doctors and six of us took MDMA together. And after about 40 minutes, one of the group was missing. And we started looking around and we found her cowering underneath the sink in the bathroom. And that was an early lesson in all the things that you're saying about preparation, about screening, about being prepared, about knowing what to do. We knew how to take care of her, and we did without medicine, but it was still a frightening experience for her until it became a mastery, which we taught her to make it into, which is, conquering the adverse effect with some of the techniques you're talking about, particularly breathing, which again was very effective with anxiety. I'm going to switch topics now and ask you a couple of very personal questions, and I hope you don't mind. One is, what do you eat for breakfast typically?
Well, right now I'm on a keto diet, so I eat eggs and meat preparations and try to stay in a state of ketosis because I'm trying to lose weight. I'm 68 years old. I try to exercise. I get in 5,000 to 10,000 steps a day. I try to do yoga. I try to do resistance training because there was a book called Getting Old is Not for Wimps. So I want to be as prepared as possible. And if and when, well, not if, but when the time comes for me to leave this veil, I don't want to leave it in a decrepit position. And I don't want to leave it cowering and being afraid. I want to exhale that last breath and go into it.
I'm so with you, Robert. I'm going to be 85 next month. I spend about 10 hours a week in some combination of aerobics and weightlifting, and I have to, because if I don't, what you just said starts to happen. And it happened to me during the pandemic when the gym was closed. I atrophied so suddenly, and it felt like sudden aging. And now, since I'm back on the program and working out last 16 months, I've got my strength back. I feel vigorous and I feel young again. But it's what you said, though. You got to put in the time and the work, particularly when you get older. What do you have for lunch?
Same kind of keto type diet. I eat things that are low in carbohydrates, high in proteins and fat. And then each week I weigh myself, and I also check my urine to see if I am in ketosis.
You go a whole week before weighing yourself?
Yes.
I would be scared to do that. I can gain weight so quickly. I weigh in every morning. Now, what do you have for dinner?
Similar type things, based mostly on low carbs, meats, and
extremely and high protein.
Yes.
Okay. What are your thoughts on building up cholesterol in your arterioles while you're on this heavy meat and fat diet? Do you believe in cholesterol theory, or you more fall down on inflammation?
I'm an advocate of inflammation processes, but I'm also aware that some of the literature on eggs and fats, you have to distinguish good fats from bad fats.
Right.
So we do need some fats, but I tend to, because I don't want to lose muscle mass, I use more protein than fat.
So I am dealing with the same thing, of course, at 85. And so a few years ago, I switched to bison for my meat because it's so much lower in cholesterol and in calories. And now I'm moving towards a new piece of research on chicken gizzards and octopus. Chicken gizzards turn out to be extremely high in protein, and they're okay with regard to cholesterol, modest, and so is octopus. I'll give you a report in a few months after they're on order and waiting for me at the supermarket. But for right now, I'm with the bison. But see, when I go as far as you go in that direction, my mind tells me, watch out for building up cholesterol. Are you taking a statin?
No, I get my regular blood checks and my HDL still good.
Your HDL's good. Yeah, mine's terrific at 61 from all the exercise. But how about your LDL and your little baby LDLs? Are they okay?
Yes, they're okay.
Well, good for you. Then you're okay. Hopefully. Yeah.
Yes.
I say hopefully because you can drill down in those little LDLs down to very fine particles. I've done that a few times because I love data on myself and other places as well. Of course. Robert, it's really been a pleasure listening to you. It's been educational. We're going to post this on the internet, and parts of it will be in my book. We want to get what you're saying out to the world. It's very helpful and important.
And I would encourage people to look at the links, because that article is one that's representative of the research that's ongoing now. I mean, being done at esteemed institutions. And there's also a video by a young lady who's in Switzerland, which is also very informative. So I think people can use those as a foundation for their own personal research and their own personal education.
When we send our newsletter out announcing you as a guest, we'll be sure and put those links in so that the people will be able to get to them quickly. So thanks again. We'll be in touch maybe in another year, 9 months or a year. And thank you all for listening to today's broadcast of Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. Remember, we broadcast every week, 9 o'clock Tuesday mornings. If you want to listen live, most of you listen on the archive, which many of you know is open source, meaning this is our contribution. We're not charging for all this information from the brilliant minds that come to Mind, Body, Health, and Politics. Check us out on social media. We're getting involved with that through our dear friend Joshua, our social media expert. We're on LinkedIn and Facebook and Instagram and a YouTube channel. And of course, you want to check out my recent book, Freeing Sexuality. I think you'll dig it. Until next time, this is Dr. Richard Lewis Miller reminding you that good health is worth fighting for, and it's essential for life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.